crime prevention expert, retired Fairfield Police Lieutenant Jim Perez, with Crime on the Mind. Exclusively on Melissa in the Morning. WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM.
You know, it's interesting. So Jim and I didn't plan this ahead of time, but on our way home from Vermont yesterday, my husband brings up that Connecticut drivers have to be some of the worst. And I said to him, are you kidding? You're from Massachusetts. Literally, you can't say things like that. He's like, no, I'm telling you, I've seen the driver's etiquette just plummet, especially in the last few years. And he's like, and I've had it. Like, the driving alone is enough for him to just drive out of the state, no pun intended. And so, interestingly enough, you know, Jim, you know, he reaches out to me and we're talking about what are we going to discuss this morning on the show. And he says, do you mind if we kind of talk a little bit about, like, people who don't use their blinkers and just kind of driver's etiquette in general? And it brings up a topic that he and I have discussed in the past, and I want to rehash it again this morning, which is, should people be retested for their license more often? Would that help with the issue of driver's etiquette? So, of course, without further ado, we have Lieutenant Perez here for Crime on the Mind. Hey, Jim, how are you?
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Thank you so much. No, I'm serious. My husband, literally, if it's not the snow, it's the driving. He's like, other than, you know, being close to your family, he's like, that alone would drive him out of Connecticut. He can't stand it. He really can't.
Yeah, we do have crazy habits and crazy drivers, but it fits very well if you're traveling in New York City. Other than that, it's kind of like it could be annoying. But, you know, this goes back to, I know we talked about testing and all that stuff, but let's forget about that for a second. Let's just think about what happened recently in recent history, which is COVID, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when COVID happened, people stayed inside the house, and all of a sudden, when a driver decided to go out and about, they had the road all to themselves. So they were driving fast. You weren't really seeing police cars out. You weren't really seeing people out. And I think that, you know, after a year of that, people got used to it. And now we come out of COVID and the driving habits are still remaining. So, yeah, that's part of the reason for it. But the other part is what you and I have always talked about, and that's the fact that we don't ever retest. So you can be 70 years old, and the last time you got tested was 16. And unless you have your faculties in place and you're good, you forget all the rules of the road. And there are a lot of them. You know?
Yeah, no kidding. But that's what I mean. Like, things, you know, and I loved what the listener brought up to you, which was the lack of using a blinker. I mean, I don't know. It's funny, but I get made fun of sometimes because I will put my blinker on. You know, if I see that we're a quarter of a mile before we take the exit, I will put my blinker on. And sometimes people are like, oh, my gosh, why is your blinker on? I'm like, well, I just want to let people know that I'm going to be slowing down. I'm going to be getting off the exit here. And, like, don't be on my behind, if you will. But
yeah,
how many people
I'm the same
blinkers?
Way, actually. I try to do it ahead of time. And really what I'm thinking of is the person behind me. Right,
so, exactly.
So I think what we've lost is this, you know, this sense of having care or well-being for the person behind you, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's why
true.
When you open a door, you look behind you. And if you have any type of manners, you wait and see. And if someone's approaching, you wait. You know what I mean? And you do that because of fellow humanity. You just want to do something good for them. But unfortunately, people don't think that way. Not everybody.
That's
and
true.
Some people are very selfish. And whatever they do by not holding a door, they transfer it right to the car. And when they get in the car, that habit continues. And technically, some of it is against the rules in Connecticut state law with respect to driver etiquette. And the manual clearly spells it out. There's a 25-question test that's given, and everything's in there. Yet everybody forgets it because it's been so many years. And you're right. We need to come up with a program or a system where, you know, you're not being necessarily tested like as a punitive thing, but you're being tested just to refresh your mind.
Right. Like, I don't know why when they renew their license, why they can't take like a quick 10-second, and it doesn't mean like a pass fail, you get your license revoked, but just kind of a refresher course. Like, I know when I was becoming a travel agent, for example, they have you do, you know, refreshers, and you get quizzed at the end. If you get the quiz wrong, you've got to do the quiz over. You've got to read the material over again.
But Hold the presses. You are a travel agent?
I was for a quick second there. I was, but it was way too hard to
balance. So you still have all the knowledge and all the requisite whatever.
Why do you want me to book you a trip, Jim? You got to get out of here.
Yeah, I'd like to know, because you know what? Any break you can get is a break, right?
You're so funny. Yeah, no, we could definitely
talk
about it.
Everybody listening, and now we have a travel agency with us. Hey.
Oh, but here's the only catch. The only catch, though, Jim, is that it's only for Disney properties. So that doesn't probably help you much at all, because I think your daughter's older. Yeah, see? I'm not that fun. It's only
we'll
for Disney.
We'll have to expand you a little bit.
We'll talk about it. Yeah, we'll definitely talk about it. I mean, but I love you for asking that, though. You're just so authentic. I love it. But we had to take quizzes at the end of any time we had to renew something or if we had to learn a new piece of material. And if you failed the quiz, it wasn't like, oh, no, you're not getting your license. You had to then just go back and reread, you know, what, the 5 minutes of material, or you had to take the quiz again, essentially. So it was embedded in your brain. And I don't know why we don't do something like that. It can't cost a lot of money to do, like, an electronic quiz. I don't know why
we don't
do that.
No, and I'd love to see that happen, because I think it would be beneficial to every driver. I think it'll be beneficial to the state as a whole, and especially I think it will be beneficial to every police department that has to respond to stupidity that has to do with crashes and wastes our resources that can be better spent other places for people who really need help and not just nuisance accidents, I like to call them, or crashes. You know?
I agree. Okay, so we have a lot of questions that have come through in the last few minutes, Jim, so we're going to kind of get through them. I will say, and I want to share this from one of our listeners, really great insight. He was saying that if you're going to retest here in Connecticut for licenses, which isn't a bad idea, that should be something federal, because we have people who come in and out of Connecticut constantly from New York, from Rhode Island, from Massachusetts. So I think we'd both agree on that. This should be something that the entire country, I don't know why we don't retest, but I thought that was a great point. Here was the first one. Let's start with the listener that you spoke with, Jim. What are the rules when it comes to using your blinker?
So anytime that you're actually approaching a turn, so a planned turn, then you should, there's a 3-second rule, right? So let me just go back a little bit before I answer that question. So when you're driving, right? You should be standing behind someone at about 3 seconds. What does that mean? When you look at the rear of the vehicle of the car ahead of you, pick a landmark, a pole or whatever that it just passed, and it should take you exactly 3 seconds to get to that pole. If you do that, you're in an equal distance. But same thing with turning a signal. If you plan on turning right, or you plan on turning left, or you're slowing down, you should always use your signals. And unfortunately, people don't do that. And then you catch the driver behind you by surprise, because they might not be paying attention because they're looking for just lights, right? And so they're driving along and they're assuming that if there's no lights coming on in your car and they're behind you, they're just going to keep driving. And this is how the rear end accidents happen. So it should be 3 seconds. Before you reach your destination, you should count out 1,001, 1,002, 1,003, and then make your turn. So at least 3 seconds you should be giving a warning. And honestly, not only is it proper etiquette, but it's just common sense, right? People are constantly looking for lights. That's what they're dictated by. And so that's how you should react. But to answer the question, it should be about 3 seconds, at least 3 seconds or more before you make your actual turn.
When do you use your hazard lights? That was another one that somebody asked about. Is it something where everyone's stopping short, people will put their hazard lights on? Is it only when you're on the side of the road broken down? When should you use your hazard lights?
Well, you use it when you break down, right? I know that a lot of bus drivers, especially school bus drivers, will use it if an intersection becomes clogged or you know, stifled for whatever reason, it starts to stop. People will use their emergency hazards, but really you use it if you're stuck. You pull off to the right as far as you can, and then you put your hazards on. It does a couple things. It actually warns other people there's something actually wrong with your car. And then more importantly, if a police officer or a tow truck driver or an emergency services vehicle pulls up, they'll know that you're in trouble. That's really when you use it for the most part.
What is the protocol, Jim, for passing on the highway? As I mentioned before the break, it seems like we now have it kind of backwards. And specifically, we even had people call in and say, what's the statute of driving in the left lane? I think it's that idea of the slower lane versus the faster lane. People are passing in the wrong ones. It seems like we have it backwards here in Connecticut.
Well, on divided highways, like let's say like highways like the Merritt Parkway or I-95, right? Well, even like Route 58, 59, any of the routes, any of the state roads, what really happens is that when you have two lanes, the left lane is simply supposed to be for passing, exactly for how it's described. So once you decide that you're going to overtake a vehicle, You have to make sure that you have broken yellow lines before you actually do that, because the state is saying that in this area with the broken lines, the line of sight of visual is safe enough where you could actually overtake a vehicle. But here's the thing. Some people just think that they own the road. They really do. They think that they own the road. And how dare you try to pass me? I'm doing the maximum speed limit or whatever. But the reality is, and the law is, that when someone is about to overtake you and they go on your left, by law, the person on the right is supposed to slow down and let that person overtake them if they're doing it legally. Unfortunately, what happens is, because we have crazy drivers who really don't know the law and don't know the rules, they will either start messing with that driver by speeding up a little bit. And I know everybody has done it at one point or another, so don't look at me like if I'm crazy, because I'm not.
I don't think
it actually happens.
Yeah.
And I think that we have a responsibility to go back to the basics and the fundamentals, and that is that if someone's going to overtake you and you're going slow, you should be happy that they're overtaking you, because why do you want them on your butt all day, right? So
yeah,
you have a responsibility to slow down and let that person overtake you, and then everything will be fine.
Yeah, I think that that's a really good point. And also, we're talking to Jim Perez. I know we have a lot of questions about driving etiquette. Some we won't be able to get to today, but we'll do the best we can. Why are tinted windows allowed? This was a question from someone who said, what are the rules around tinted windows? I'd imagine that it's harder for police to make stops or see what's going on, illegal activity, things like that. What are the rules around tinted windows?
There's different. So depending on the vehicle, there's different rules, right? So you have your sedans, which are your standard cars, which are a lot lower to the ground. It has to be non-reflective tint, and you have to allow at least 35%. Listen, every police department has a tint meter. It's called a tint meter. It's a little box. It's a little bit longer than the size of a cigarette box. And what you do is, if you get stopped for suspicion of dark tints, they will ask you to lower the window, which, you know, you could lower it 3/4. Because remember, driving is a privilege, not a right.
Mm-hmm.
So the state wants certain things enforced. The police officers have a right to go up to you and tell you to lower your window. And when they ask you to do that, lower your window. That's all there is to it. And then what they'll do is they'll put this meter. There's like a slit in the middle of the box that goes like 3/4 of the way up the box vertically. And they'll put it on top of the window. And, of course, these things are always calibrated. And they will calibrate. And if you allow less than 35% of light into the car, especially the front windows, the front side windows, the windshield in front, you could never put tint on. But the driver's side and the passenger side window, it's 35% of light or more that has to be allowed. If not, then if you come up with 20% or 25%, then it's illegal. They can actually issue you a citation or a warning. Now, it's a little bit different for SUVs and vans, because they're a lot higher and they're bigger. So the backside windows, because on a regular sedan, the front driver's window and the window right behind them in the passenger side has to be at least 35% of light coming in or more. For SUVs and vans, you could actually tint. You got to allow 35% in the front, you know, driver's side and passenger side, but the rear seats, you can, it could be any darkness you want. It could be totally black, like where you can't even see inside.
Yeah, that's crazy though. Don't you think, Jim? Like, I feel like that's crazy that that's not handled better.
I think what's crazier is the fact that the state allows, and this has been not just Connecticut, this is pretty much, you know, everywhere, but the state allows rear windows to have any type of dark tint. Anything.
Yeah, that's insane.
So that creates a danger for police officers who are actually approaching the car from the left or right.
Exactly.
And I think that's crazy, but that's the law. You know,
well, maybe we need to fix the law. Just saying. And Jim,
by the way, because this is such a big subject and such a huge one, I think we should talk about it more than a week, because there's so much to go through. But more importantly, since the state won't give you a test, maybe us, WICC and Lieutenant Jim Perez can give you a test. What do you think?
I think that's a really cool idea. I think that would
live
be really
on the
fun.
Air, but we'll do it not now, though. Maybe
no, we won't do it
time,
now, but only because we ran out of time. But I love that idea, Jim. And because I am away next week, when we come back the first week of October, let's plan to do, maybe we do like a multi-week series on just driver's etiquette. Because, again, I still have a page of questions. These are all questions that literally came in the last 5 minutes from listeners.
And that's legit, because there's a lot to go over. There really is a lot to go over.
So maybe we launch that in October. I think we launch that in October. I think we do like a multi-week series on just driver etiquette, and we have some of these open conversations. And yeah, I think we do a test. Maybe we do something like that, and I think that would be really fun. I think it'd be very proactive.
And I think the listener needs to realize they're not going to get this anywhere else. You can't go on cable. You can't go on TV. You can't go on satellite. It's here. Mm-hmm. It's just all right here.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I love that. I'm just going to make a commercial and have you just say that. That would be great. Great promotion, Jim Perez. But no, this was a great start to the conversation, though, Jim, and I look forward to doing more on this. Not next week, but after that. I think in October we do a lot more on this, and certainly before even the cold months, that's also when we have another liability, which is ice and snow and all that great stuff. So great timing for it, and I look forward to talking more about this, Jim. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Have a great week.
Thank you. You too. Lieutenant Jim Perez for Crime on the Mind. We will talk more about driver etiquette in the coming weeks, so keep your questions coming. We really appreciate it. Good morning. We have seen it in the news, especially since the beginning of the school year, that some schools have detected mold in their buildings. In fact, it wasn't that long ago that Middlebrook School's principal initially reported that elevated levels of mold spores were found in four classrooms. But school officials said at the most recent Board of Education meeting that mold also grew at Cider Mill. And there have been many other school districts that have dealt with mold issues. The one that always comes to mind for me, just because I have friends who are teachers in Stamford, are Stamford schools. They've had a lot of issues with mold in the past and making teachers and students sick. And we know that that is one of the municipalities that the state, when they are allotting a lot of money for new HVAC systems and better ventilation, Stamford is getting a good chunk of change out of that money because they've had so many issues with mold in the past. And it's only been a couple of weeks, as I mentioned, since the start of the school year here in Connecticut, and some students are already facing a major outbreak. This time, though, we're not talking about COVID. We are talking about mold. Natural Home Solutions has been on the front lines, apparently, of restoring classrooms across the state safely for both the kids and the environment, and educating parents and administrations on how mold works. The first step to solve a problem is to understand how the problem even begins or how it works. The co-owner of Natural Home Solutions is here, Laura Champagne. Welcome to WICC. So glad to have you here.
Thank you.
So tell us, if you don't mind, I kind of gave a little bit of a background on Natural Home Solutions. I know that you have mold testing detection and you are a removal company trying to keep properties safe, not just here in Connecticut, but in several states across New England. Tell us, what made you want to get involved with this kind of work?
I wanted people to understand what mold is and how it works. Problems are scary when you don't fully understand how they operate. And mold is a naturally occurring thing. And so it is very frustrating when people don't understand how it works. And we need to fight nature with nature. The trees and everything in our environment have spent millions of years to adapt and fight their own problems. So I wanted to help people and have people really understand what mold is and how it works. That way they can solve it.
Do you mind sharing some of that insight with us here on WICC? Like, what is mold and how does it work?
So mold is like a dandelion. Everybody knows when you're a kid, you love to pluck the dandelion from the backyard. You pick it up, has those little white things, and it flies through the air. And mold's the same way, but you can't see it. So the part that's, like, toxic to you is the little white things on the dandelion. So when you can see the mold on the wall, it's already been releasing all of its little seeds into the air. And that's how it works. That's how it spreads. And mold loves humid, dark places. So inside your walls, inside all of your building materials. Whereas just like a plant, they like sunlight, good soil, and water. The mold likes kind of the opposite. So even when you can't see it, it still can be a problem. And so you want to fight it from the inside out. When you can see it on the outside, it's kind of a big problem. And the product that we use is an enzyme. So a chemical stops at the surface. The product that we use is an enzyme, so it travels through the walls, travels through the places that you can't see. And so many people fight mold by cleaning the surface, and that's not how mold grows. It grows inside where you can't see it.
Now, when you say that toxins can be released into the air, like, what can that do to a human if they are breathing that in constantly?
It can aggravate all of your respiratory systems, and it can create inflammatory responses. So things like asthma and allergies can magnify. And they're really just doing more research now to figure out what it really can do. Just like how some people are not a little more prone to get poison ivy and some people aren't. It's not a blanket thing across every single person, but it definitely will enhance different immune responses. And especially you will get a lot of allergy-like responses, cold-like responses. And anybody with asthma or breathing problems, it will make them far worse.
We are talking about mold detected, especially in schools. We've seen that in the news recently here in Connecticut, but certainly it could be detected in your own home or even at your place of work. And so joining us to talk more about this is Laura Champagne. She is the co-owner of Natural Home Solutions. And Laura, my understanding is your company in the entire New England region is the only one to use what's called NZ Cleanse. What is that and how does it actually treat mold?
NZ Cleanse is a product produced by Expor, a life science company. And the way that it treats mold is that it starts off as a liquid. It's a proprietary blend of enzymes and citrus oil. So it gets put into a fogger and it gets atomized and becomes 60 times finer than a human hair. So when we fog that in, it creates a little bit of a haze in the room, and it's able to travel through all of your porous surfaces, which are drywall, plaster, wood studs, cement, concrete, and then all of your products in your home. It doesn't disturb anything. So it goes through your mattress. It goes through your curtains. It goes through literally anything, but it doesn't disturb anything. So it travels through because all those places or can live and they can grow. Any of your items, if you have mold in a room or in a basement or in a classroom, if you move that item to another room, you're going to bring the mold with you. So it goes into everything and starts unlocking it because an enzyme is like a master key. So it unlocks each piece of mold. So it can't create more mold. It can't release its spores. So it does not reproduce.
Is it safe to use this and have, humans or pets not get sick from any of it?
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. The gentleman who created it puts it in, you wouldn't want to drink the whole gallon. You don't want to do any of that. But the gentleman puts it in his mouth. I treated right when I started with the company, I treated my own home. I have a 2-year-old German Shepherd that licks everything and she is absolutely fine. It's not a chemical. It's an enzyme. It's a natural thing. So there is zero problem. It's safe for everybody.
And what do you suggest? Do you have any tips for schools, homes, business owners, to prevent mold growth?
Mold, it's one of the funny things. Mold found outside is a very natural thing. So it's not really a dirty word, and that's why there is a solution for it. You want to minimize the possibility that it can actually grow. You want to take away the things that let it grow. So humidity is a big one. If you have to run dehumidifiers, the best thing is you want to have moving air. So if you run a dehumidifier, you have a fan in the opposite corner. You want to make sure that your air is always moving because air quality is the most important thing. They also make things called air scrubbers. So if you're still trying to figure out what your problem is, you can install an air scrubber. They're loud, but you can move them around. So a company or a school, you can move them from room to room and really purify that air. You can pull all those spores out of the air while you're trying to figure out the problem. And with our product, I work with some clients as they're trying to figure out the problem, or if you have things you have to rip out, you know, we want to make the environment safe for your workers as well. So you can do the treatment and then like a cursory treatment, if you will, to make things that just safe, and then do all the work and then come back and do a bigger treatment. But really, it's air quality is number one. Keep your air moving, keep your humidity down, and purify your air.
And Laura, if people want mold testing done, they want to get an estimate on treatment, where can they go to get more information?
Naturalhome.solutions.
All right, so just go right online to naturalhome.solutions, and they can, you know, they can get an estimate. They can contact you guys and get.
They can contact us. We come out. We do different testing, and we guide our. We go hand in hand with our customers. It's not a mold is one of those things where everything is different customer to customer, and we walk everybody through step by step to make sure it's a specified process for each customer and treat it that way.
That's excellent. So again, go to naturalhome.solutions if you want to learn more. And Laura Champagne, I want to thank you for the work that you do and everyone at Natural Home Solutions and for sharing that information right here on WICC.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Again, Laura is the co-owner of Natural Home Solutions. And if you want to learn more, go to their website, naturalhome.solutions. We just got back from a beautiful weekend celebrating my younger sister, who married the love of her life in Vermont this weekend. And when you look at wedding industry statistics, it's pretty unbelievable. The wedding industry has become a billion-dollar industry as people have started to follow the traditions and then even create their own, like welcoming parties, like morning after brunch, like signature cocktails. It goes on and on and on. I mean, it really does. Not to mention that there are 80% of couples out there who prefer to spend the money on destination weddings. So where they get married, for example, technically this past weekend was a destination wedding. They are both from Connecticut, but they decided to get married in Vermont. And so when you look at the amount of money people spend on a wedding, the question is, what is the focus when you decide to get married? Is it the wedding, the big shebang, or is it actually the marriage, the reason you're going to celebrate? And so we have Bob Donovan back on the show with us, our marriage consultant on the morning show and going strong. We've now had him on the show. How many years, Bob, have you been working with me on this?
In June it ended our third year doing this.
It's amazing. It's so incredible. So anybody who's new to the morning show, Bob is on every couple of weeks and we talk about different marriage topics because marriage is important. Relationships are very important and unions are very important. And unfortunately, we are living in a world where it's taken advantage of. It's not, it's not prioritized. It's not cared for enough. It's not looked at enough. And so we try to make that a priority here on the morning show. And so Bob is back with us. He has worked for a very long time with his wife in counseling couples and just coaching couples is a better way to put it, and helping to support marriages stay very strong. So Bob, welcome back. So glad to have you here. How are you?
Yeah, good. And congratulations on your sister's wedding.
Yeah, she was awesome. Great. Pastor Steve did the wedding, and they mentioned a lot in their vows, things that I could tell came from your outline. I know they didn't work with you, but they worked with the counselor who's on site with the church, and I could tell there were a lot of aspects of the training that they took away. So yeah, it was beautiful. I'm very happy for both of them, certainly. But you could tell, you know, this weekend that certainly there were a couple things that I was like, wait, seriously, you need this? But you could tell that it was about the marriage, at least for my sister and her husband now. But that's unfortunately not really the case with a lot of people, huh, Bob?
Yeah, it is. You know, I have three daughters, two of them are married, and that day is special. It really is. So it does require effort and planning. It absolutely does. So I'm not saying don't do that. Don't get married at a VFW. Like, I mean, some couples have to do that, which I respect that. However, most couples, I don't know about most couples, but a lot of couples go into their marriage focused on that day, that planning of that perfect magical day. A lot of you know, a lot of young women, they just dream about of that day. So I do get that. Again, we married two daughters, so I do get that. However, I guess what I'm suggesting now is that a lot of these young couples, I would just hope that they kind of shift their thinking a little bit from planning out a day and think about their marriage. A wedding and a marriage really are two different things, right?
Mm-hmm.
The wedding
Absolutely.
Is the ceremony, right, that starts your marriage. So, and that's one thing. It's my wife and I really have had a passion for this, and this is where we've probably invested most of our energy in the last 18 years, is helping couples get started with the right foundation. You know, one thing I realized early on about 2005 is that there's not a lot we can do for a couple that's been married 18 years that are struggling, that have had really tough time and they haven't addressed things. It's almost too late. And my heart was burdened for them. And I said, I'm not sure how much I can do for them, but I know I can help couples start their marriage with the right foundation.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of how we started, really about 18 years ago.
So talk about your program. What does the breakdown look like for couples who go through your premarital?
Yeah, well, the first thing that just blew me away, I didn't realize this, but when you look at statistics, I mean, they were just overwhelmingly in favor of these programs. That, I mean, it's anywhere from 40 to 70% of couples that take this reduce their divorce rate dramatically by taking programs, going to counseling, things like that. So that's like, man, if I was engaged and I heard that, I'd go right down to a
I'd sign me up for every
church.
Single one. Yeah,
absolutely. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the first thing I did not realize was that significant, but it is. We've learned over the years that there's really several components that we want to address and help couples think about. And, you know, and I'll run through a few of them, probably the biggest one, and I'll talk about that in a moment. But, you know, understanding the purpose for your marriage. And, you know, we'll get into that a little bit, but we talk about the purpose of your marriage, the role of your faith in your marriage. Obviously, we talk about what I call authentic communication, you know, expressing yourself and listening. Obviously, money, intimacy. And we wrap it up with a session we call Evaluating Your Relationship. And I have numerous tools that we have couples that objectively assess the health of their relationship. I also might add that we get couples that are seriously dating, thinking about getting engaged, as well as couples engaged that are going to get married. And in the ideal world, I would love to have couples seriously dating and thinking about getting engaged, taking this program, and then again, going through that objective assessment to understand if they're healthy enough to get engaged. That's where that's the sweet spot right there.
Yeah, so it is interesting that I feel like we call it premarital classes, but we sort of, a lot of people wait until you are engaged, but it's true. We live in a society where people move in together before they're even engaged. So it is interesting that we don't take classes to see if we're even ready to get engaged, like if this is really the person we should spend the rest of our lives with.
Yeah, you know, and that's if I say anything here, that's one thing I've seen a shift. And when you and Derek went through the program, I don't know if you remember the dynamics of that class and how many were engaged or just dating. But right now, you remember, like,
everybody in the class was engaged. Yeah, there was one couple that was technically engaged, like they didn't have the rings or anything, but they knew they were going to get married. So I guess they were dating, but everybody else was engaged. Yeah. Yeah.
How about that? Yeah. So right now, anywhere from 30 to 40% of couples are seriously dating.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a big shift.
That's amazing.
A really big shift.
I'm glad to hear that, though, because that means that people want to avoid getting divorced. They want to know they have authentic relationships, and that absolutely matters. Our marriage coach, Bob Donovan, is back, and we're talking about the need for couples to take pre-marriage either counseling or take programs, because it actually it lessens their likelihood of a divorce. And we're talking about the focus of your wedding versus your marriage. What does some of the data show, Bob? What can you say about this and really what you have been able to teach couples? What have they learned by getting premarital advice or coaching before saying I do?
Yeah. So over the years, and I do track this, you know, my corporate job, I worked in manufacturing. So we were all about statistics and numbers and adding value. So I track things.
I know you do.
Over the years, we've had 224 couples go through our program. Like, that's astounding. Like, I cannot believe that we're getting old, you know? So, and I looked at the data and how, because I know a lot of these couples we still know. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, I one stat I hate and one stat I love. The stat that I love is that 10% of our couples, after taking our class and going through this process of the 8-week class plus the mentoring, which is also part of this, 10% of the couples decide to postpone their wedding or break up.
Wow.
Because, and you know what? I don't tell them, we don't tell them that. Like, I never will say that.
No.
We'll never say that. We don't think, that's not our business. The process, and especially the last session about evaluating a relationship, the process leads them to self-examine their relationship in an objective way. So 10% of couples, so 22 couples decided to postpone their wedding to get more help or to break up.
Mm-hmm.
And I really, if I look at like one statistic, those are, you know, 22 couples that likely would have ended in divorce.
Yeah.
So very happy with that. The statistic that I hate is 7% of our couples have ended up in divorce. And, you know, you're going to say, let's, you know, 7% is a good number, but you know what? That's like 13 couples that I know.
Yeah.
And I know that you know that. It's
sad.
Very sad.
It is really
it's
sad.
Very sad.
No.
Yeah.
It is
so
sad.
Anyway,
it's awful.
We do look at, I do look at statistics like that.
So what have we learned? You know, over the years, what have we learned about this?
I'll tell you the big thing, I know, this could be a way, way, way deeper topic, but the big thing is that the couples, I look at, like, what do couples learn that ended in divorce? Like, mm-hmm. That's what I want to know. Like, what happened? Because is it something that we should have emphasized? Like, I look at it, I want to know, tell me what happened. And the number one reason why couples ended up getting divorced is because they got married for the wrong reason.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I know this is from, I'll give you just one example, but it illustrates, I think, many that ended up in divorce, that a couple got married, and 3 years after they got married, the woman called me up and she said, I want to meet with you. And I said, great. So we sat down. I didn't know this at the time because they moved away, but they got divorced. And I said, oh, that's so sad. And she said, I want to apologize to you. I said, why? She goes, because I wanted to get married so badly that I tuned out when you were trying to tell us and look at the health of our relationship, because there were signs that I ignored and I didn't want to see, but you were leading us to see them. So I owe you an apology for that.
But it's true, you know, like we focus on, you know, I just want to be happy, or this is the next step, or I've been dating for so long. We should be, you know, we focus on things that but we miss, you know, maybe the red flags that are like, listen, this is not healthy, or you need to work on this before you decide to do that. It's true. That is true.
Yeah. And that's an assessment that we do at the last class. We call it a red flag assessment. And there's mm-hmm. 22 questions that we ask them to do individually. And it's so funny that, again, if they do this right, that's going to tell them. It's going to show them and tell them that they're not ready enough. And I'm not saying they all should break up. All it means is take a step back, maybe get some help, maybe get some more insight, mm-hmm. maybe learn some tools. That's all it means. So that was one big learning from this class, that many couples get married for the wrong reason. And, you know, one question that comes out, and all these couples ask, like, what is my future husband or my future wife going to be like? Right? Many, all the, they come and they want to know that. And actually, I answer that. I said, well, what are they like now?
Right. Because you think like once you get married that they're going to, like, be –
right.
Some kind of expectation. Sure.
Yeah, there's going to be some magical switch that flicks in the marriage ceremony. The light's going to go on.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe somebody who's more controlling or has some anger issues or selfish, maybe they're going to change a little bit. But that is not true. So, you know, and actually, it makes all that worse. So if there's those issues, marriage is like a crucible. It just makes something worse. That's, you know, and the heat, it makes the deficiencies show up. So we try to illustrate that and show couples that, you know, and another big message we get is this: get healthy before you get married
mm-hmm.
and deal with your past. You know, so many of us, we're not raised the right way. And you bring that into marriage, that if you avoided conflict when you were a kid, you're going to really avoid conflict in marriage. If you had anger issues, you're going to really have anger issues. So we try to help couples look at that as well.
And I think that there are a lot of things, like you said, I think this is a two-parter, Bob, because honestly, I think there's a deeper dive into this, like not just the lessons, but also what are some good reasons to get married? What is the purpose of getting married? What, you know, and I think we continue to dive into this because there are so many different scenarios that people, I think, can connect to. And also, I think we do another interview talking about, okay, so what if you already got married? And you realize that maybe you missed, like, I'm going to be honest, we missed a lot of those red flags. We got married. Derek and I probably should not have gotten married right away. I'm glad we did get married. But we probably should have worked a lot of different stuff out, which I know you know. But we realized years into being married that I was like, whoa, that could have totally killed us. So I think that this is worth doing more on. I think we do continue deeper dives, especially because we are in the height of wedding season right now. And so if you're open to that, that would be great. And in the meantime, if we have a listener who would like to reach out to you and talk to you about their scenario, what's the best way to get in touch with you?
Yep. Yeah, it'd be perfect. This is a deep topic. It really is. So mm-hmm. I think that would be a great idea. And yeah, I'd love if couples or a man and woman has an issue with this at all, they would love to have an email. Shoot me an email at bdonovan, D-O-N-O-V-A-N, at blockrock.org.
That would be great. And Bob, thank you so much. We are so glad to have you back on the air, and we'll continue the conversation the next time you come on. That would be great.
Sounds great, Melissa.
All right. Bob Donovan, our marriage coach on WICC.